We're having a very, very fraught discussion in this country of ours about citizenship. And it's a source of a great deal of pain, a great deal of controversy. Also, I would say hatred. Hatred is coming up. And also, love is coming up. But we're very unsettled, you know, in this country about this question. And I was reading an article in the New York Times. It's actually, you know, no different now than it has been for maybe 20 years at least, in terms of number of people that are being denied entry into the United States, number of people who are being deported from the United States, or as they so-called say, returned. That's another term they use. And so it's no different than it has been under any president, you know, since Bill Clinton. But the rhetoric is quite different now. You know, there's this sort of overt enthusiasm for this. In some quarters, for removing non-citizens from our midst. It's a very I think painful situation, and it's not getting any better. I didn't bring it up. I think I do bring it up to acknowledge that, to acknowledge that, you know, this is a really painful situation for our country. And it's very divisive. It's very divisive. So I just like to acknowledge that as we sit here today, we're sitting in kind of in the midst of a divisive situation, which is, you know, probably always the way it is. You know, from time to time, people ask, you know, well, how can we sit here, you know, quietly studying the Buddha Dharma with all this divisiveness going on around us? And yet I don't think we could make it better by not meeting and not studying the Dharma. I don't think that would help. That wouldn't help. This place is a refuge. You know, this is a place where people take refuge. It's kind of a very specific kind of refuge, but it's a place where people can take refuge, whoever they are, wherever they come from. I think we know that we here stand for that. That's our kind of, you know, we don't want to be divisive about it. We don't want to be divisive about that stand. We don't want to make people wrong who feel differently. But we'd like them to allow us to be a place of refuge. You know, we want to say to the larger society, please allow us to be a place of refuge and welcoming to everyone. That's what we would like to be. We'd really appreciate it if you would let us do that. And that could be what's going on over here. I think we have to be very grateful, actually, that we live in a country, despite all its flaws, where we aren't really attacked for having that kind of attitude. It's okay for us to have that attitude. At least here in Sacramento, nobody's attacking us for having that kind of attitude, that kind of spirit of welcoming, regardless of who you are. I was thinking about, we have this thing and it's come to our attention. It doesn't come to our attention too often. You don't really think about it until the current kinds of situation comes up. And then it gets thought about more, which is we have this, I think it's a clause in the Constitution of the United States that says if you were born in this country, if you are born here in this country, you are a citizen, regardless of where you came from, regardless of where your parents came from. If you were born here in the United States, you are a citizen, and so there's been, now we're very aware of this, right? We're very aware of this, and we're very aware of the term. Birthright citizenship. And actually it turns out that people are willing to pay a lot of money to actually come here pregnant and give birth in this country so they can be U.S. citizens, because that's our rule, that's our law, that's the way it works here. So we have this clause in the Constitution that says just by virtue of our birth, we are citizens. We have all the rights and responsibilities pertaining thereto. I think it says something like that somewhere. And this is consonant with something that we were studying. Some of us here, a lot of us here actually, we're just at Green Gulch Farm practicing Zazen with a bigger community and attending Dharma events and working in the fields and working in the kitchen. Practicing together and living together, actually, in most of us, all we're living together in one building. this is kind of element that, I've had in my life, residential practice, where you live and practice together. And this is actually in the history of Zen, this is actually more the norm than what we do here. In the history of Zen, it's more coming and living in a community and practicing in a community. That's really sort of what distinguished. There were other Buddhist groups doing this too, but the ethic of living together and working together and self-support in a communal living arrangement is very characteristic of what Zen Buddhism has always was or was historically. So we were kind of going back to the original kind of practice that this tradition has been noted for throughout its brief history of 1500 years or something like that. So in that context, I brought up in a presentation to the group, I brought up the idea of a of of Buddha nature, which is kind of like birthright citizenship. We say in this concept, and I handed out a reading of Suzuki Roshi. And you want to go read it yourself. It's called Traditional Zen Spirit. And it's on page 99 of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, Traditional Zen Spirit. And then in that piece of writing, Suzuki Roshi says that ever since the time of Bodhidharma, now really when you say ever since the time of Bodhidharma, you're saying ever since the time that Zen became identifiable as Zen, okay? Ever since Zen began, ever since the time of Bodhidharma, it's been axiomatic in this school it's been an encouragement of this school that we practice this practice with kind of confidence and faith in our original awakened nature, which is the same as Buddha's, that our nature and Buddha's nature aren't different. So it's been, you know, since the time of Bodhidharma, he says, it's been axiomatic. I don't think that's the word he uses, but that's the word I'll use in this school, that we practice this practice with confidence and faith in our original nature, so that we and when we do that, it helps us avoid the idea that we're practicing to become different than we are, to become more something, or you know, more awake, or more enlightened, or to reach some goal. So it's kind of that kind of teaching is kind of an antidote to that kind of way, you know, end-seeking mind or goal-seeking mind or thinking that we're doing this to get something. The idea is no, the way is basically perfect and all pervading, and just know that, and it pervades you, and it's pervading you right now, and you can just practice from however it's appearing right now. And even it's appearing, even if the way is appearing as scattered thoughts and turbulent emotions, still our understanding is that this is, you know, basically or fundamentally an expression of the Buddha's wisdom. Now, this is not to say that everything is just rosy and ducky. You know, the Buddha's realization, according to one story, the Buddha's realization was that when he had some big experience on his cushion, he verbalized at that time, and he said, "Now I see that all sentient beings possess the virtues and wisdom of the enlightened ones." So that's what I've been talking about. Now I see that all sentient beings possess the virtue and wisdom of the enlightened ones. But he had a but. According to this story, Buddha had a but. But because of their delusions and attachments, they don't see it. They don't see it. Let's see, Larry and Oscar and I were just at no abode on, we can't get enough of this stuff. So we went down there again. And we were at Noah Boat on Saturday, and Reb talked about it like delusions and attachments covering up, covering Buddha nature. That's another common way to talk about it, that Buddha, that delusions and attachments cover up this beautiful, shining, jewel-like nature that we possess by right, by our birthright. So this, when we hear that, we say, okay, that accords with my understanding, because it looks like things are really, you know, it looks like awakening is really covered up around here, and it's really covered up in here. You know, this accords with our understanding, right? This accords with our everyday perception. There's something missing, or there's something out of whack. Yes. Now. That's true. There was a moment, apparently. There was a moment when Buddha woke up, too. So, anyway, as I pointed out in this presentation, I made at Green Gulch, there are lots of different stories, many, many different stories and many different presentations in the literature about this awakened nature that we have and how it gets covered up. And so I'd like to tell you one of those stories. It's like a very famous story. So it's a once upon a time story. Once upon a time, there was a father and a son, and they were living in a faraway distant land. And for some reason that isn't told in the story, the son decided at a very young age to run off from his father, to leave his father's house, run away. He was a runaway. And so he did run away from his father's house, and he didn't have any resources. He didn't take anything with him. And so when he ran away, he became very destitute, and he was homeless. He was a homeless youth at a young, you know, so he was a homeless youth, and he had to wander all around looking for food and shelter and trying to scratch out a living as he went. His father, on the other hand, although greatly upset about his son running away and looking for him intensely, could not find him. And so he proceeded to go on with his life, and his trajectory was different. He became really wealthy. He became fabulously wealthy, like one percenter, you know. At that time, wealth was measured in gold and jewels and precious gems. And he had a big storehouse, and he just filled it with precious gems and gold. But he was really upset, and he was really unhappy, even though he gained all this wealth, because he didn't have an heir. He didn't have a son to pass it on to. And he was very anxious about this, and it just took the bloom off of his life. So as it happened, the son, in his many wanderings, forgot, you know, where he was from, and you know, he just became a homeless wanderer, and he wandered back to the area where his father lived. And he came to the mansion, this huge mansion where the father was living, and he saw his father, although he had forgotten, because he was so young, he had forgotten what his father looked like. And so he saw this stately gentleman sitting on the let's say, on the deck of his mansion, you know, and on a lion seat, according to the story. And he was, you know, he had servants all around and jewels, you know, fine clothing, and he really looked regal. And the young man thought, this must be a great man. This might even be a king. I better leave here quickly, because this person might send some men to seize me and take me into his household and enslave me and make me work. And so he ran away, but not before his father saw that it was his son. His son had come to that place. And so he sent, you know, two of his men after. So just like the son thought, the two men came after him and grabbed him. And he was incredibly frightened, and he fainted dead away. And a father came up and said, okay, this isn't working. Let him go. But, of course, he wasn't going to lose track of his son. So what he did is he went back and he said, you two guys, you disguise yourself as a couple of poor beggars. And you go, you know, that look like him, you know, destitute homeless people. You go after him and offer him a job with double wages. So the two retainers go after him disguised, and they make this proposal to him. And he says, well, okay, that sounds okay. And you said, you can come to this mansion and you can live in the stables and you can sweep out the horse dung. You can sweep out the horse dung. And the guy said, okay, well, that sounds, I can do that. That's my pay grade. You know, I can do that. So he came and started that job. And his father, of course, really wanted to get close to him, but he used skillful means. And what he did was he himself dressed down and rags and poor clothing and put dirt on his face and so on, and went into the stables. And he acted like the foreman of the stables when he went in there, and he's telling everybody what to do. So the young man figured, well, he's the boss, but you know, he's not the king. And so the father now could gain the confidence of his son a little bit, and he started talking to him and saying, you know, you're really doing a good job here, and I really want you to stay on, and I don't want you to go anywhere else, and I want you to have what you need, and I want you to even have an old servant that can even work for you, with you. And I don't want you to work too hard. I want you to enjoy your life here. And so he convinced the young man, who still didn't know that this was his father, to stay around. And after a time of gaining the son's confidence, he said, well, there's some more duties that I'd like you to take on. And this was like years, right? Years go by of this. And the son still has this idea that he's basically just a shit shoveler, right? That's all he's worth, and that's all he does. He has a great sense of, you know, not worthiness, not really, you know, someone who could live in a great house or anything like that. He has no idea of that. He has a very low and low opinion of himself, and great feelings of inferiority. But over time of gaining a relationship with the man who actually was his father, and then his father said, I'd like you to come into the house, and I'd like you to organize the jewels in the storehouse, and I'd like you to take inventory of the jewels in the storehouse, and I'd really like you to know how many jewels are coming in and how many jewels are going out, how much gold I have and how much silver I have. And so at this point, the son, after many years of thinking poorly of himself, thought, well, maybe I could do that. And he went into the house and he went into the storehouse and he took inventory of the gold and the silver and the gems. And some more time went by. And then the father decided he was going to die soon. And he needed to do the big reveal. So he brought together some friends of his. They came to that place, some relatives, and he made the big announcement. He says, "This is my son. He has been working here for 30 years. And now I give him, from this day forward, turn my entire estate over to him. And he will own all of this and take care of all of this after I'm gone." And the son, after all these years, was quite surprised. quite surprised to find out that what he thought was never going to be his was all his, and that it always had been his. It always had been his inheritance. It always had been what he was going to get. But he never strove or never had an idea that he would want anything like that. But at that time, he was quite joyful. It says he was quite joyful. And he was ready to accept that great wealth and accept his inheritance. After many years of thinking he was inferior and not worthy and not one who could manage a great house, he never had an idea that he could do that. And then at the end of that time, he was ready to hear that. And he was ready to say, "I will inherit this great estate." So this, of course, story is from the Lotus Sutra. You know, it's the parable. The chapter is called Faith and Understanding. Faith and Understanding. And it's the parable of the destitute son. The parable of the destitute son. So the destitute son had this birthright all along. But because of his delusions, because of running away, because of wandering, because of many causes and conditions, he didn't realize it. He did not realize it. So this story, you know, this is one of the greatest stories in Buddhist literature, I think, or you know, in the Lotus Sutra. It's certainly one of the a great story, and so consonant, I think, with so well. I know for myself, it's very consonant with my experience. I feel so identified with this story in a way. It's so much like my life, and it's so much like the life of so many people in my generation who, having some life in some affluence, needed to run away for whatever reason, you know. And I know so many people that did that, and I was one of those people. I grew up with not jewels and silver, but plenty, And I had to run away from that. I had to actually become destitute. It was important to me to become destitute. And I succeeded at that. I succeeded in, you know, hitchhiking around with only, you know, like a little pack on my back and some worn out sandals that, you know, could hardly stay on my feet. And I needed to do that. And I didn't do it thinking, well, I'll do this and then I'll become affluent. I just needed to do that. And it was really, really important. And that's not even important. What's important is the psychological destitution that I experienced, the alienation, that's not what I experienced, that's not what's important at all, but it's that you know, if you if you have a period of wandering in your life and alienation in your life, the great thing is you can have that period, and it's really great if you don't get stuck there. It really is good if you don't get stuck there. And you know, I think maybe a lot of people had some period of that like that in their life, and probably nobody here got stuck there, and so we're pretty lucky. So I think, you know, the practice, of the Buddha way may involve, I think it maybe even aided by some period of wandering and destitution and alienation. And maybe it's necessary to go through whatever you have to go through, whatever feelings of inferiority and not being worthy, and then come to a place where you may realize these feelings of inferiority and worthlessness, that's not my true home. That's not truly who I am. And to begin to have some appreciation and some confidence in a different vision for yourself and a different vision for other people. The vision is not cramped. You know, we can have such a cramped vision of ourself. And so, you know, maybe practicing is like massaging out the cramps. It's beginning to have some confidence in your path, in some faith and understanding. And then practicing from faith and understanding, not practicing from a place of, you know, unworthiness. Maybe I can, I'm so unworthy, but maybe if I do this practice, I'll become worthy. I probably thought that at some time myself. I probably thought that way. Please let me find a way to become worthy. Maybe I thought like that. I know I had a much diminished view of myself, a much impoverished view of myself. That's for sure. So, you know, even if you have to, you know, shovel dung for 20 years, maybe at some point you can let that go. Yeah, let that go. Start a Dharma Center. Get together with a few people. You know, have a bigger vision of what you could be and what your friends could be and what the community could be, maybe what the nation could be. Not this cramped version of this nation. Not this cramped version. Let's not stick with that. Let's not settle for that. Let's not settle for it. We can be better than that. Do you have anything you want to bring up?
Where are the jewels around here?
Three sanghas, three jewels.
You gave a talk at Green Gulch, and I don't remember exactly what you said, but you were saying, oh, you're all good people, and you're golden, or something like that. So I was doing zazen, and I was like, oh, maybe I'm not doing this right. Like, wait, I'm a good person. And it was, I gave myself a break.
Mm-hmm. One thing I was going to mention, I think what I mentioned was, you know, practicing from a sense of your own goodness, you know. I think that's what you heard. And one time I was at Sashin at Hartford Street, and I had this crazy dream during, you know, it was a really crazy dream. But in one part of the part that I really wrote down in my notes was, there was a rear view mirror, and on the back of the rear view mirror it said, you good. You good. You good. And I said, thank you. You know, so yeah, practice, yeah.
Of the song from Woodstock. Right now, I'm not Judy Collins. Who wrote Woodstock? The song? No, they sang it, but they didn't write it. Joni Mitchell, thank you. So, and I was crying by the end, and the line that just gets you every time is, we are stardust, we are golden, caught in a bargain with the devil, or caught in the devil's bargain. And I thought, God, that's right where we are right now. Mm. We are caught in a society, caught in the devil's bargain. And the song is so, go home and play it on the computer and cry too, because it'll just bring up feelings that you need to be reminded of.
Well, you know, they keep making a big deal about this is the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, but it's also the 50th anniversary of Woodstock, yep. Which to me is equally important.
I was there.
Not more so.
I was there.
I should have been there. I was almost there.
And that's the way we felt at the time. And I had a little discussion with somebody recently. Is this period in history more difficult than the Vietnam War period or not? And for me, it feels worse. Because back then, I was young and I had hope. Now that I've depressed everybody.
Well, I remember the line differently from the song.
I'm just ad-libbing it.
We are stardust, we are golden, and we got to get ourselves back to the garden.
Yeah, that's there too.
Yeah.
We've got to return to the garden.
So, you know, that's consonant with what I'm saying here tonight, you know. I mean, we should have a vision of the garden, I think. You know, we should have that kind of vision. I mean, and, you know, we didn't get a big heads about it or something like that, but to have, I mean, this, I think I've said this before, I mean, this is a path of knowledge, and it is a path of vision. So, you know, to have a vision of Buddha lands, of people treating each other kindly, people treating the environment kindly, people working together in harmony. I think we should hold on to that, whatever the, you know, however much it looks worse than ever.
The grand quarters that we find ourselves living in the world, I think it's important to remember that crampedness arises out of unworthiness. You know, those who feel unworthy tend to want to repress others. And we can't know how hot the fire is inside of those people, too. And so out of our vow of compassion, let's help others find a way out of their crampedness, too.
Yeah, for me, that's key. I mean, this is the path of the Bodhisattva. That's all it is. That's all it's ever been. That's all it can be. This is the Bodhisattva path. It's the path of wanting to become awakened in order to help all sentient beings. And the first thing that happens, from what I've learned, is that you recognize through equanimity and through the Brahma Viharas, the worthiness and the lovability and the kindness of all sentient beings, and that without the kindness of others, you know, we aren't anything without the kindness of others. And I mean, there's nothing but the Bodhisattva path.
Funny in my mind prologue to this, you know, story I told in the Lotus Sutra. There's these three, you know, very advanced, or three or four very advanced disciples who speak at the beginning of this chapter, and they say, well, we're old and tired. We're old and tired. And we've settled for a vision of the path that's just, you know, resting in nirvana. We're old and tired, and we've settled for just resting in nirvana and formlessness. And, you know, I guess now we will muster ourselves. We'd like now to muster ourselves to hear your teaching, Buddha, of the bodhisattva path of this larger vision of the bodhisattva. And who vows to return to the world and carry all beings, you know, to liberation. So, you know, I don't think we're around here in danger of resting in nirvana, but you know, we might be getting a little old and tired, and I think we actually shouldn't settle for that. We shouldn't rest there.
Well, Bruce is scribing something, but I'm not really sure what his intention is. And he's got a personal story here, and though I've been with him these many, several dozen years, I can't. He's telling me that he has a parallel. He was at West Point, and he is a parallel in his plebeian at West Point. And I don't know what the corollary is. Can you give a little bit more on that? I don't know how to articulate what's in your heart. Did I say it right? Okay, good.
I don't know what it was like at West Point, Bruce. I imagine there were some pretty high standards you were supposed to meet. Probably a lot of people thought they were faking it. I don't know. Sometimes when we have imposed high standards on us when they don't come from inside, it can be a feeling of kind of faking it. Yeah, that could result in some feelings of alienation and estrangement.
I was thinking there was probably a lot of shoveling shit.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Thank you for your attention.